Cliff Berrickman has been doing Bigfoot field research since 1994. His expeditions have taken him to 46 states and 5 continents in search of evidence supporting the existence of undiscovered hominoids worldwide. As the evidence analyst on Animal Planet's hit television show Finding Bigfoot, Cliff has applied his skills and expertise to a variety of photographic, video, film, and sound evidence. He has appeared on many other television shows and documentaries as a Bigfoot specialist and cryptozoologist. Cliff is especially familiar with the footprint and handprint evidence for Sasquatches, and he is a curator for one of the largest collections of cast evidence in the world. His collection includes impressions from North America, Asia, Australia, and Europe. Cliff and his wife Melissa own and curate the North American Bigfoot Center in Boring, Oregon, which features the largest public collection of Bigfoot evidence in the Pacific Northwest. Besides his Bigfoot interests, Cliff also is an accomplished guitarist. You can often find him quietly strumming on the porch of his rural property on the western slopes of Mount Hood, deep in the heart of Sasquatch country.
Are listening to Mystery Media Group.
Yay! So I just want you to know that I'm drinking out of my Bigfoot cup today.
That's very nice.
I'm wearing my Bigfoot shirt, so.
Nice.
Good.
So Cliff, we're very excited to have you on. We're big fans of your show. I am a big fan of your podcast. I've been listening to it all day. So we're grateful that you took your time out of your day to talk to us. We were talking about what we wanted to have you say, and we had all sorts of questions and we had all sorts of things. But what I'd kind of like to have happen is we get to hear a lot of Bobo story time. I'd kind of like to have one of Cliff's story time, because we went to Phenomicon in Vernal, Utah, and Russell Accord showed the video of Bob Gimlin about the rainstorm afterwards. I did not know that. I had never heard that part of it before. And so we got to watch that video, and it was absolutely, I mean, that's what all of our trips are like. Something has gone wrong, but those are the trips that we remember the most and the ones that we have the most fun with. So do you have any super scary encounters, something that's crazy that you did? You got stuck, got lost?
That's hard for me, because especially as I'm growing older and older and older and older, I am remembering less and less. Sometimes it worries me, but at the other time, I'm okay with it because, you know, what is that saying? You know, a jar is only useful if it's empty. We do Bobo story time because he has such an amazing life and so nutty, and he remembers or misremembers in a sort of exaggerated fisherman sort of way his stories, you know, and he's just so great at it. And of course, everybody loves Bobo for, you know, being who he is and stuff. I've had some nutty stuff happen. I've almost died lots of, I mean, but I don't remember a lot of this stuff, which is so strange. I know to hear me say that. My go-to is that, you know, back in 97, I think it was, I was an overenthusiastic young Bigfooter doing my thing out there at Bluff Creek. And I went out there with a couple friends with this delusional, naive idea of I was going to find for sure the Patterson-Gimlin film site. You know, and we all started walking up the river, and I got ahead of everybody else. And unbeknownst to me, they turned around and went back to camp. Went back to Louse Camp. And we were walking up. I didn't know about the H spur yet, the 12 and 13 H. I didn't know about all that kind of stuff, where the bat boxes were, or any of those sort of things that most people know about now if you're going to the PG site. But, you know, I just kept plowing forward and thinking that I would, naively thinking I would recognize it if I stumbled upon it. Then, of course, I walked right through it. Now I know that. I walked right through it, didn't even see it, and kept on going. So it was a long walk up, and then I noticed how low the sun was getting at the time. And I said, well, maybe just right around the corner, maybe around just around the next corner. And I kept doing that until I looked up and I go, oh, crap. oh no. And I turned around and, you know, I started like sprinting across the sandbars and knowing that if I follow the river back, if I follow Bluff Creek downstream, I will eventually run into camp. I did, but it was about 11:30 at night by the time I got back there. And being young and dumb and everything else, that, you know, I've grown out of a couple things. I've grown out of being young, but I haven't grown out of being dumb yet. All I had with me was a backpack with a peach. I had a water filter with no water container. And I was wearing shorts and a t-shirt and river sandals, and that's it. And I knew, you know, it was July or something at that point. So I wasn't going to die. Well, that's just it. I mean, I could have died. My biggest enemy at that point was a combination of a twisted ankle and hypothermia. Cause you can get hypothermia when it's warm outside, and the water, of course, at Bluff Creek is very cold. And it was, and at first it was like, oh my God, it's so dark. And, you know, I got to put some miles under my feet. It was a long ways up the river. I think I was up past Scorpion Creek. I'm not sure though. Cause I didn't know at the time where I was. So I just kept moving cause I didn't want to get hypothermia. I just kept moving. I was in the river cause it's a lot of places it's too hard to walk out of the river. I'd walked out of the river whenever I could, of course, but for the most part I was in the river. And then, you know, your thoughts turn to bears. Cause I know that there's probably more bears in that part of California than almost anywhere else outside of places, you know, isolated locales like Yosemite Valley or something like that. And then mountain lions. And of course, I was looking for Sasquatches at the time. So all these things are in my mind. And it was so, so very dark. There was no moon that night. I remember that very vividly because there were many times during that long, dark walk that it was completely black on all sides. And all I saw was literally the light at the end of the tunnel. It was the moonlight. No, it wasn't moonlight. There was a starlight like 100 yards down the river on these straightaways that I would sometimes wander into, where I could see the darkness was not quite as dark as everywhere else. And it's like, oh, going to keep my eye on that and keep plunging forward. And then at some point or another, I was tired. And then eventually, you lose fear. You lose fear of bears and mountain lions and Bigfoots and stumbling and, you know, hypothermia. You just kind of lose that stuff and you trudge. Eventually you're trudging to get back to where you need to be. And at some point I look up and I go, oh, there's the bridge. It's the Bluff Creek Bridge. You know, finally I know where I was. That means I'm only 1 mile from camp now after walking for several hours in the dark without a light through rivers. So I got out and hopped on the road. And then I walked all the way back to camp at that point. And when I knew I was getting close to camp, I took one of those emergency whistles out. Like just started blowing it because I knew my friends were going to be back at camp at Louse Camp. They never heard it until I was like 7,500 yards from camp, which tells me how completely useless those are. Because trees absorb sound like water sponges absorb water. Oh, and then when I got back to camp, I was pretty pissed at them for turning around and all that sort of stuff. And they were pretty pissed at me for pushing ahead and being over enthusiastic. And I was sore and tired and cold and just exhausted. And so I just collapsed and fell asleep, you know, on the ground outside the car, you know. And when I woke up in the morning, my friends were kind enough to put all my stuff in the car. And apparently they locked my keys in the car. 20 plus miles back at Bluff Creek, and thought I was going to have to break the window. But luckily the back in the cab was open just a little bit. And we found some, you know, wire coat hanger or something and fed it in. And you know, got my keys out or whatever. That's the story that always comes to mind. But there's been so many weird things that have happened to me over the years. I just kind of forget them all, honestly. I only have so much RAM is what it comes down right to, you know?
Right. Or you're like Mike and I, and it happens every single time. So you're like, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There's weird things. Like I was at my younger days. I remember I was out of Bluff Creek looking for Bigfoot. I didn't find any Bigfoot, of course, but I found the biggest sock I'd ever run across in my life. That was a weird sort of irony there, you know? So like weird things like that, they pop up. But you know, that's probably why I hang out with my old friends a lot is so they can remember the good times I've had. Cause I can't.
Well, we seem to run into a lot of adventures where we go out almost every weekend and do stuff like this. We go on crazy adventures and we call it the Mickelson curse. We're brother and sister and something always goes wrong.
So we were on our way here and my daughter's with me and she said, we're interviewing Cliff. And I said, yes. And he's the guy who does all the Bigfooting. I said, yes, he is. He gets to talk about that and do that for a living. Yes, he does. And she was be such a cool job. And I'm like, yes, it would. Lucky guy.
Yeah, and it is. I'm very, very fortunate. This is my job. I don't make a lot of money or anything like that, but my bills are paid. And what else can anybody ask for?
A good friend of mine,
Dana, who was one of the camera guys on Finding Bigfoot, he told me once, you can only make two amounts of money, which is enough or not enough. And I'm blessed to make enough. I don't have a lot of huge desires and stuff. So I'm okay. I'm okay. I do get to do this for a living, but you know, like everything else, it's a blessing and a curse. There's a lot of good with it. There's a tremendous amount of good with it. And there's some bad as well. And I'm very lucky to have it. But you never know where life's going to take you. I guess if you look at my career path, it doesn't make any sense at all. I'm kind of the poster child for do what you like to do and see if it works out in some ways. Because, you know, I have a degree in music and then taught elementary school for a living for 14 years. I worked in fishing tackle when I was young. That's my first job. And then I was on television for 9 years doing that. Now I own a Bigfoot museum. So it's a weird life path, and one that I could have never predicted, or I certainly didn't expect. And it's also something that I didn't really choose, in my opinion. Looking at my life, it's just kind of been a bunch of fortuitous missteps that have led me here. And you know, it's the divine accident, I suppose, one of those things. And that's kind of how I try to live my life. If try is the right word there, I'm not really sure it is. I let my life be that. And I do my best to not interfere so much with the mechanics of the universe, more like just kind of guide me. I envision my life kind of like floating down a river in an inner tube, you know, and you can see obstacles up ahead, but you're just in an inner tube, you know. You could subtly influence your direction, but you certainly can't steer this thing. And you're heading downstream no matter what you do. So that's how I kind of live my life and my grander philosophy on how things roll. So again, I didn't choose this. It feels to me like it chose me. So I'm trying to honor that as best I can.
That is a good analogy.
It is. And I think it chose you because out of everybody that I've read or listened to or seen speak, you and Dr. Meldrum are so good at presenting the evidence, at presenting, just you put it in a way that makes it so much more understandable, I guess.
This sounds like an insult, but I swear it is not. I taught 10-year-olds for a living, you know, this is not a slight against you or anybody else.
General.
It really is not.
I don't take it as an insult at all.
No. Some people might. I just wanted to preface that. And if you can explain it to a 10-year-old, you know, then you can explain it to pretty much anybody. There's a lot of science going on in this world. I joke with Dr. Meldrum, you know, he is the conduit between the subject and other academics, essentially. Yes. And yes. For whatever reason, I've been thrust into this role of being the conduit between the subject and the layperson. And I guess that's my role, and I'm very thankful for it. And again, I didn't choose this, that I'm just lucky. And I'm just doing the best I can with the task that has been set for me.
I think that's your superhero ability gift right there, is breaking it down for people like us.
I'm just like you guys too, you know. I'm just a little nerdier perhaps about it, you know, and just found myself in a weird position.
How did you get started with Finding Bigfoot?
Well, I mean, I was teaching and stuff, and I was Bigfooting as much as I could. I had a blog at the time. This is when blogs were kind of a thing, and I'm a pretty good writer, I suppose. Did a little bit of TV stuff before. I was on an episode of Monster Quest with Bobo one time. Did some stuff like that Bob Saget show. I did an episode up there. And somehow or another, well, the show got pitched. The show got pitched without any of us. I think it was Brad Coolman, who's the owner of Ping Pong Productions, which is the production company that did the show. He pitched it to various networks, and Discovery is one of the pitches. He told me that when he went in and pitched it, he said that, look, I grew up in the 1970s, and what I remember about the 70s is Farrah Fawcett, Evel Knievel, and Bigfoot. Like two out of three of those things are dead now. We need to do something about the last. And that's kind of the hook that he used. And so they picked it up. And so they started, there's all these people looking for Bigfoot. Why don't we just mine that population to see if anybody in there works? I think that's how they got Moneymaker on board, because the BFRO is already in full swing. Bobo's just a big character, of course. And they got my name from somewhere, and they called me up. And I remember Todd called me. He's in charge of a talent, quote unquote, is what they call us. Anybody on screen is called talent, whether they're talented or not. So he called in November probably 2009 or 2010. And he's kind of pitched like, hey, we're doing this show and spare no expense, look for Bigfoot, land, sea, and air, all this stuff that didn't turn out to be true. He said, would you be interested? Then I go, well, yeah, maybe, sure. It's okay, cool. Send me some footage of you and whatever else. And where else can we read more about you? Oh, here's my blog, et cetera. I think they found me through my blog. And then Matt and Bobo or whoever else was involved at that point might have recommended. And I don't think they had their spots either. They were still fishing for people. So I sent them some stuff. And the following May, Moneymaker calls me. He goes, Cliff, you got the spot, man. You're on. And great. Fantastic. What are you talking about? And he goes, oh, remember that dude who called? I go, oh, and yeah. Oh, that was real or whatever. And was, yeah, we're going to be filming in Alaska in June. And it's like, oh, okay, cool. Free trip to Alaska. Let's go Bigfooting, you know, that kind of thing. And they shot a bunch of footage for the pilot and they sent it to the network. The network liked it. So they picked up 6 episodes and then we went out and shot first season. And the first season is when we really kind of molded it into the format that you would recognize as Finding Bigfoot. Pilot itself is unrecognizable as a Finding Bigfoot episode, but they liked the footage that we got enough. But we also had to go back to Alaska that first season to the same spot and refilm a lot of the things to fit it better in with what the show actually became at a later date. So, but yeah, that's how I got involved. I know that they were shopping around and other Bigfooters. A lot of my friends went to meetings with these people and whatnot. And I guess at the end of the day is that I tested well with focus groups because that's kind of how they decide these things. So I don't know. There you go.
See, it called you. You didn't go looking for it. What got you started in going out and trying to find Bigfoot originally?
I've always been a weird guy, you know, pretty eccentric, on the edge of things and a nerd on top of it all, you know, finished my schoolwork early and go to the library kind of guy. And of course, I also grew up in the 1970s with In Search Of and all those sort of shows and the schlockumentaries, I'd like to call them. And so I've always had weird interests. But at the time, it was crystal skulls and Atlantis and monsters and whatever else was cool, you know, for a little boy growing up in the 70s. But when I was in college, I had a few hour break between classes on the other side of the campus. It was so far away that it didn't make sense to go back and, you know, practice or go off campus for lunch or something like that. So I stayed in upper campus. This is at Cal State Long Beach, a very, very large campus. So I went to the library and kind of wandered through the stacks and pulling books off of the shelf and subjects that I was interested in, which was mostly science at the time. And I stumbled across a couple books. It was the Halpin and Ames book, Man Like Monsters on Trial, and also Scientist Looks at the Sasquatch by Mercotic and Krantz, I think, were the editors on that one. And I started reading scientific journal articles written on Sasquatches from the perspective of anthropologists and whatever else. And so basically, when I started reading the evidence, the actual evidence of Bigfoot, it started like going like, well, how does this make sense unless this is a real animal? It doesn't is the answer. And the more I read, the more solid that that conclusion became. And I was, you know, I was going to school and, you know, kind of dicking around in general as a kid. You know, that's what you do in your early 20s. I was already backpacking and camping and whatnot. So I just basically started camping and backpacking in places where people had seen Sasquatches. You know, just got more and more and more into it. And in the early 2000s, 99, 2000, 2001, somewhere in there, I started networking a little bit with other Bigfooters because I was already very well read at that point. And I was up on the news and I was just kind of a lurker on all these early forums and stuff, the IVBC and the first incarnation of Bigfoot forums and all that sort of stuff. And then I got an invitation through I don't even know how, from Kathy and Bob Strain. She was Kathy Moskowitz at the time, to come out for a training exercise in the mountains. And go, oh yeah, yeah, totally. And from there, you know, they were kind of my doorway to other people. And there you go. That's how it started.
Did you know Matt or Bobo before you started the show?
Oh, before the show? Yeah. I met both Matt and Bobo on a BFRO expedition to the Redwoods in like 2004 or 5 or something like that. I met them both the same trip. So yeah, I knew both of them for years and years. And we had gone on many adventures in between. Because Bobo was a commercial fisherman for a living. And so
I didn't even know that.
Oh, yeah. He's had a million jobs. And most of his jobs were focused on trying to see a Sasquatch. You know, so he took logging jobs. He took road building jobs and brush clearing jobs. Because he's hearing people were seeing him on fishing boats. Yeah, so he was a commercial fisherman when I met him. And his off season was my off season as well, being a teacher. So we would spend weeks together out there at Bluff Creek because he had the time off and so did I. And Moneymaker and I spent a ton of time together as well, particularly like in the 2008 timeframe, somewhere in there. Yeah, I knew all those folks. I didn't know Renee. I met Renee in Alaska, I think, or on the way to Alaska to film the pilot. So
was she specifically hired to be the skeptic?
Yes and no. I mean, she was the last hire. We picked her up just like a month or something before we headed out to film the pilot. Moneymaker recommended her because she had been corresponding with Moneymaker about various Bigfoot things over the years up on the Olympic Peninsula. Turned them on to a location up there on the north side of the peninsula to go Bigfooting from all of our native contacts.
Cool.
So several years ago, we went to your museum and you showed me a picture that somebody sent you from Howe, Idaho. It was a picture in the snow of a footprint. And so we went up there. It's not far from my house. And we spent quite a few weekends in the area, the same mountain range. And we came across a track set and a bunch of other things happened. But how big an area do these guys travel in or live in? Are they pretty centralized?
We don't know, but there's a lot of speculation and thoughts out there. But from what I've seen, the data is indicating that they don't move as far as people think. I've heard crazy speculations about them moving from the Southern California mountains or Southern Sierra Nevadas all the way up to British Columbia. And I don't see any reason to think that's true at all. They're just stories. But when it comes down to actual evidence, it comes down to actual footprint evidence that one can analyze. And then prints are pretty weird, but they're really telling. It turns out Sasquatches can be identified by their footprints, just like a person could. You can tell, your footprint versus maybe your wife's or anybody else. If you look at enough footprints, you can start identifying individuals, essentially. And this is true for Sasquatches as well. So the data that I have seen that has spanned years indicate that the same Sasquatches are frequenting the same areas for many years in a row. And that this has given us a lot of insight into not only behavior, but also social structure and territory size and that sort of stuff. So the two or three best examples of an isolated locale that has the same Sasquatches in it seem to indicate that this is just best guess. And there's a lot of variables like food resources and all that kind of stuff, how close people are. I don't think they're moving very far. The spot we have, one of the spots we have our eye on right now here at the North American Bigfoot Center is we're finding the same individual's footprints in the same area. In fact, we have found four trackways, I think, maybe five, all within a half mile of each other, and they seem to be the same animal. And in this particular area, it's very telling as well because the Sasquatches that are seen are of different colors. There's a real big white or light colored one. We're not sure if it's white or if it's like a coyote sort of colored thing. There's a black one and a brown one, which may be the same one as the black one. We're not sure, but there's also a one that's distinctly red, a reddish color, like an Irish setter sort of thing. So we know there's at least three individuals in this area. We haven't tied one to a certain footprint yet, but we have at least three individuals based on the sighting reports, and we're getting the same individual in their footprints as well. And so as near as I can figure, and again, this is all really loose at this point because honestly, there's not a lot of data. This particular area seems to indicate that they're staying within maybe a 10 to 15 mile on each side square or rectangle, something like that. That seems to jibe pretty well with the Blue Mountain evidence as well. Here at the North American Bigfoot Center, we are curators of Paul Freeman's research map. We have the original research map on the wall.
I was just going to ask you about that. So cool. Yeah. Keep going.
And then we're kind of working on tying together individuals' footprints. The Blue Mountain evidence is really interesting because it represents, footprints from 1982 until about 2000 or 2002. So basically 20 years of work by a group of people, not just Paul Freeman, of course, Wes Summerlin and Dar Addington and Bill Lowry. David Bean, the list goes on. There's a lot of people contributing to this. But out of those people in that 20 years of work, we're looking at probably four or five Sasquatch individuals out of the 50 or 60, 80 casts that were obtained during those years. And the area does seem to be kind of similar, maybe 10, 20 miles by 10 or 20 miles.
20 miles is not unreasonable that they would wander around in.
Oh, no, not at all. Not at all. At the same time, we have an example from 1958 and 1963, in the Bluff Creek area, where the large male, the animal that gave us the word Bigfoot, the Jerry Crew footprints from October of 1958, that animal's footprints were found a number of other occasions throughout the Bluff Creek area, but also down in High and Palm, California. That generally speaking, most of the footprints from that animal, his name was Bigfoot, we're saying he because there's a large footprint, presumed male. Bigfoot's footprint was found in mostly August through November-ish in Bluff Creek. But in April, it was found down in High and Palm, California, which is 60 air miles away. Turns out it's one ridge all the way down. You have to cross a river, but it's still the same ridge. We just don't know. The data's not there because Bigfoot people, humans, Bigfooters, are so interested in the stories and not the actual physical evidence. But we need to get up and go above that now. We need to go beyond that and start collecting physical evidence so we can learn more about the animals instead of learning about us and what moves us and what scares us or whatever. But Bigfooters don't seem to be very interested in collecting the physical hard data. So we don't have a big enough data set at this point to really make any strong statements about things like territory size. We can start to guess. There is some evidence out there, but it's not enough yet.
So I know you talk a lot about being a citizen scientist. What are your suggestions for helping to collect all that data? What should we be doing as citizen scientists to contribute to that?
I'll tell you what I do. Every time we go out, we have a questionnaire that we fill out at the North American Bigfoot Center every single time, even if nothing happens, which is most of the time. It's nice and short. It makes it easy. It takes about 5 minutes to fill out, but that the data is compiling. Where'd you go? Who was there? How many people were there? What'd you find? Any files associated with it? Blah, 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 blah. There's like a simple thing, Google form we fill out every single time. You need to be putting dots on the map. Instead of collecting the stories and getting the human reactions out of it. See, humans are terrible observers in general. I don't put much faith in what anybody says. You know, I always try to check things and I always, always try to realize that whatever experience they have, whatever observation they had, which is even a better way to say it, has gone through many filters by the time it reaches my ears. So I try to separate observation versus interpretation of events. And at the end of the day, most sighting reports are a dot on the map. Somebody said they saw a Sasquatch at this location at this time, essentially is what it comes down to. But that's really important. And when you start doing that in active areas, what you find out is that most of the dots come from the same spots. In fact, it got to an absurd level here at the NABC. It was last summer, the summer before. I think it was the summer before. Somebody came in here and said, I saw a Sasquatch back in the 1990s or whatever, you know, some date. I said, well, where'd you see it? Oh, down in the Kalawashi. Oh, yeah, was it on this road? Blah, 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 this number road? And they go, well, yeah, it was actually. How did you know? I said, well, that's because everybody sees them there, you know, or right around there. And you're going to find that. You're going to find that, that if you start collecting reports and plotting where they are on Google Maps or Google Earth or on a map like Paul Freeman did or whatever, you're going to see that most of the reports come out of the same spots again and again. And those spots tend to be 5 or 10 miles by, or 15 miles by 10 or 15 miles, you know, that's the very beginning of doing it right, in my opinion. Find the spots. And also if you do that, suddenly you don't have to drive to Bluff Creek anymore because you know where the spots are around where you are.
Right.
And so you want to go to the same spots, even if nothing happens, as much as you can, even for day trips. I got 3 hours to kill, but my spot's half an hour away. I'm going there. That's the kind of thing it takes. Put your boots on the ground as much as you can. And learn the area. Learning the area is just as important as seeing a Sasquatch, getting a vocalization, or any of that stuff. Learn the area so you know what's out of the ordinary when you're there. And you know, honestly, walk the roads. That's what we're doing. That's all we're doing. We're walking the roads and we're keeping an eye out because signs of Sasquatch are so subtle. Even a really good footprint. We have this amazing footprint that was collected by a great researcher named Laurie Jo Hamilton, good friend of mine in the Olympic Peninsula, an example footprint on the wall. And when people say, how come people don't find more footprints? They go, oh, they do all that, but this is wide. Look at this. And then I can see it's a blank face. They look at the print and they go, they don't see what I'm looking at. They don't see what I see in it. And then I said, yeah, this is one of the best prints obtained or whatever. And they're just like, what? Cliff's an idiot. I said, no, look at this. And I point out the heel and I point out the toes. 4 out of 5 toes are visible. And they go, oh, I do see that. And I go, that's why people don't see more, because it's so subtle. Sasquatches have big, soft, padded feet. Everyone's looking for a Gray's Harbor cast. Everyone's looking for that cast that is jumps out at you in the sand, that there's no doubt it could be anything else but that. The vast majority of footprints are just not like that. They're subtle. They're subtle, subtle, subtle things that barely impress into the ground in ways that you wouldn't expect. And so walk the roads and look for things that are out of place. And journal notes, take photographs of everything, and you know, just do the best you can with what you got.
What are other things to look for besides footprints?
I'd say the other things to look for visibly, I mean, you could always look for tree snaps and stuff. When you're going along the road, it's kind of hard to find them because they have these brush hogs that they put on the end of excavators that, you know, that clip away all the brush and stuff on the side of the road. So it's not easy to find stuff next to the road. And most tree breaks can be written off as wind or snow or, you know, elk or deer, you know, rubbing their antlers against it and that kind of thing. You want to look for tree twists because those are a little bit harder to for nature to replicate. But beyond that, you're mostly using your ears. Or you can always find deer kills and things like that, but those are very rare as well. And when I go out, I'm mostly looking for anything that's out of place. I haven't found a footprint for quite a while now. It's been since last May that I found a footprint. Even though I go out there, I try to get out there like once every week or two or something like that. At least for a couple hours, go walk around. Although it's under snow now, so that doesn't help either. I'm not a snow guy. I hate it. Last time I was out, I found this big yellow turd that I thought was really interesting. I don't know what made it. There's no toilet paper nearby or anything. And it certainly jumped out. But it wasn't there on the walk in. And I thought that was unusual. It sure jumped out at me on the way out. And it was in the middle of the road, you know, 20 feet behind my car. Seems like I would have noticed that, but maybe I didn't. I don't know. Keep your ears open. The team here at North American Bigfoot Center, I wasn't there at the time. I was flying back from Ohio when I heard the news. My guys saw one at our research spot in August. Nico got the best look at it. And they didn't know what was following them, but they had three things following them. They thought it was deer for a while, but they just didn't know what to think of it until they saw one. And even when they saw one, they weren't sure what they were looking at. He thought it was a stump until he pointed at it, and then all its hair stood on end. You know, all the hair stood up on the back of my neck. That's it. It's called piloerection. It's an ape thing. It's an animal thing. It's a mammal thing. And that's the sort of thing that happens when we're not at ease or, you know, something is up. So I don't know. So look for things that are out of place and just document whatever you can. And you're not going to know what things are out of place unless you go to the areas frequently.
So we need to keep going back to the same location over and over again, Mike.
I would recommend that. Find a spot that's close to your home that isn't a 6-hour drive, and just do the best you can to get there as frequently as you can.
So you said that he thought the deer were following him?
Well, he didn't know what it was. That's what he thought was weird. But they were, it wasn't making a lot of noise. They just thought like, maybe those are deer. I don't know. And they didn't know if there was like a herd of deer in the area that they just, maybe they weren't following them necessarily. Not like, it wasn't like pacing them or anything. They kept hearing it no matter where they were. And then they caught a glimpse of one later. So there seemed to be three of them in the area at the time. They heard three distinct animals and they eventually saw one of the animals. So one can guess that the other two animals were also Sasquatches. But we don't know, of course, but that's what they think is going on.
I always get the question, well, why haven't we found one? And I remember you talking once about the black bear experiment. How often do you find a bear out in the wilderness? And how long
you talking about dead ones?
To decompose? Yeah, right.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, dead bodies don't last, of course, in the woods. And it's also a matter of how animals die, which nobody really studies, which I think is interesting. They study how animals rot away. That's called taphonomy, the decomposition of the corpse. But no one's really, to my knowledge, at least, studied what animals do to die, especially the apex predators, like Sasquatches would be an apex predator, just like mountain lions or bears or any other animal that no other animals would predate on. Deer and rabbits and those sort of things, they don't get to choose where they die. They're taken down by some predator, and that's where they die, and that's where their remains are left after whatever's eaten or dispersed. Apex predators like bears and mountain lions and Sasquatches, they probably get to choose where they die. They just don't realize they're going to die. They're probably just feeling ill, like most animals do. Most animals do feel ill. And so what do you do when you feel ill? You squirrel yourself away in your bed and you lay around until you get better, and there you go. And Sasquatches would probably do the same thing, just like all other animals would. And then one day they don't get better, they die. So they literally started by hiding their body in a place where they didn't think they were going to be found. They literally started the death journey that way. Now, within a few hours to a few days, the scavengers would move in and start dispersing the body parts and eating the flesh away. Maybe an arm would end up down in the ravine with the coyote pack or something. Maybe a bear would drag away a leg or something. So the body parts would be dispersed, eaten by the most plentiful animal in the woods, the deer mouse. So rodents, wood rats, porcupines, they all eat bones. But then again, so do deer and elk. Deer and elk eat bones. That's where they get the calcium for their antlers. The coyotes would do the same thing. All animals would eat bones. This bone here, this is an elk bone that we found a rotting elk carcass on one of the ridges over here that we study. And it's hard to see here, but you see these. I mean, this doesn't do any good for your audio podcast, of course, but this elk was out for less than a few weeks, like 2 or 3 weeks. And you can already see that, okay, this is intact, but this is already gone on this side. And if you see the shadows here, those are tooth marks from rodents. So already this bone is starting to be eaten away by all the animals in the area. We don't find bear bones or mountain lion bones, naturally dead bear and mountain lion bones, we should say. We do find the ones that were killed by hunters or poachers or hit by a car and all that sort of stuff. We also have to consider the rarity of the species. There aren't tens of thousands of Sasquatches walking around in Oregon. They're a very rare species to begin with. Dr. Grover Krantz, which I have to assume he knew far more about ecology than I do, he thinks a decent estimate would be about 100 bears or so to every one Bigfoot. Dr. Meldrum, he puts a number at about 100 to 200. In Oregon, I think about it like this. There's about 30,000, 35,000 black bear in Oregon. Using 30,000 bear, that means 100 to 1 bear to Bigfoot, that's 300 Bigfoots. Now, they live a lot longer than bears, but Sasquatches, they live much longer than that. All other ape species, including humans, by the way, live about 50 years, give or take a little bit, in the wild. Reason to think that Sasquatches might live a little longer just because they're bigger, and there's a biological rule that says that when some species, larger animals, live longer. You can see this in cetaceans, for example, like dolphins and whales. Whales live a lot longer than dolphins. They're bigger, it's slower metabolism, that kind of thing. So Sasquatches probably live 50 to 60 years in the wild. If they're living 50 or 60 years and there's 300 of these in the wild, I mean, according to my math, isn't that like 5 or 6 or so deaths a year somewhere in the state of Oregon? Their body's going to be gone in just probably just a few weeks to a month. I read somewhere, I think it was, God, I want to say it was Peter Burns' book, but I don't remember exactly where, a full-grown Asian elephant, where it drops and dies, there will be no sign of it in a matter of a few months. So that's why we don't find the bodies. It makes perfect sense when you know a little bit about what's going on out in the woods. You know?
Agreed. So tell us about your chapter in the Freeman Bigfoot Files book, which is new. Awesome book, by the way. It's loaded with photos and information and different contributors. Tell us about your chapter in the book.
Oh, yeah. Michael asked me if I'd be willing to write something up, and I'd be happy to, of course. I met Michael a number of years ago. He actually reached out to me because I have the Paul Freeman map, and he kind of says, hey, man, you have my map. And I go, whoa, man, well, I got it from your sister. I'm so sorry. But he was cool about it. He's obviously been very cautious about who he meets and stuff because of
his... For good reason, right.
Oh, yeah. The Bigfoot community can be very vitriolic and whatnot. And there's a lot of misunderstandings about Paul Freeman's work, his father's work, too. But I met him for lunch last year, and he saw that I was really no threat. You know, I wasn't out to get him or anything. And now we've become very good friends. See, Dr. Meldrum was given a photo album by Paul Freeman before he died. And then, of course, Michael has some other pictures and stuff from his family. And Michael didn't have a copy of the Meldrum photo album. So I gave him a digital copy, like a thumb drive full of those photographs. And then I guess he was talking to Doug Hychek about it. And they said, we should put these out in some sort of coffee table book, and kind of got the ball rolling on this project. And Michael reached out to me because he knew that I was a fan of his father's work and the evidence that they collected in the Blue Mountains over those years. He said, would you write something for this? And I go, I'd be honored to. One of the great honors of my life so far. I'm very, very pleased to be involved in that project. And I kind of asked Jeff about what, like Dr. Meldrum, what he would be doing. And I kind of got the feel of what Michael would be talking about. And I figured, well, this is something I can contribute, because it kind of reflects my overview of Bigfoot research. People ask me often, what is the most compelling piece of evidence for Bigfoot? And they expect me to say the Patterson film or the Patterson-Gimlin film or this particular footprint or this or that thing. And it's not that. It's an overview of the subject. To me, it's asking me, what is your favorite piece of this jigsaw puzzle, you know? And it's, oh, I like this one because you can see the kitty's eye or something like that, you know? It's like, well, no, it's a piece of a puzzle. It doesn't show you the picture. You know, you have to put everything together, and then it shows you the picture of what the puzzle is. And Bigfoot evidence is the same way. The Patterson-Gimlin film is great, of course. It's a fantastic piece of footage, but it's only a little bit of the picture. It's all the more astounding when you look at it in context. Like everybody knows about the mid-tarsal pressure ridge and the flexibility of the Sasquatch foot and all that stuff. You can see that in the PG film. You can see her foot doing that in the PG film and look at the footprint evidence that was collected at the site from Roger and Bob. And of course, Bob Titmus on top of that and another individual that we don't even know who it was. And then, of course, Lyle Laverty taking those photographs there. All of those mean all the more when you look at the flexibility of the foot and how that was present in the evidence at the Patterson-Gimlin film. When I was invited by Michael to write a chapter in the book, what I wanted to do was show the congruency in the data and show the larger picture of what Blue Mountain evidence means to the Bigfoot evidence. Because again, the Patterson-Gimlin film is great. But when you understand, oh, look at the midfoot flexibility in her footprints. Oh, look at that. She has piloerection as well at one point in the particular piece of film. That's a total ape behavior. That's neat. And you start piecing together all these things. It shows you the picture of these things. And I thought that was an important thing. That's the most important piece of evidence for Bigfoot is the big picture and how all these little pieces of evidence fit together like a puzzle. And I wanted to bring that to this book that Michael and Doug were putting together. Basically went over the footprint evidence and said, well, yeah, Paul's evidence, Paul casts this footprint and it shows this feature. And look at this. Here's a footprint from Kentucky that shows the same feature. Here's a handprint that shows this. There's another handprint from here that shows this. Look at this and look at this. It is congruent. It fits in the pattern of casts taken by other people in other locations at other times. And that is some pretty strong evidence when you look at the grand picture of the Bigfoot thing.
Agreed. And I think a lot of people don't realize how much evidence he actually collected. And it wasn't just him. It was a whole group of people that helped collect that evidence. So
he couldn't have done it himself. He was out in the woods a lot. He had a network of other researchers that shared evidence and worked together as a team. And if one of them couldn't go, the other one would, that sort of thing. Right. If they could, they'd go together. That sort of thing. I mean, at the end of the Paul Freeman film at Duck Spring, one of the last things he says on camera was, I got to get out of here. I'm going to go get Wes. We'll talk about Wes Summerlin. So the first thing he did was go get Wes Summerlin. He was getting back to his network about what happened that day.
I got a million questions, but we appreciate him taking the time for us.
Oh, yeah. Happy to do so.
How can people contribute to your museum? How can they contribute to your podcast? How we can support you and help support the Bigfoot community in researching all this stuff.
As opposed to supporting me, we can talk about maybe the mission of the North American Bigfoot Center, I think, because I think that's more important. The North American Bigfoot Center has essentially three prongs to its approach on what we're doing here. First prong is obviously education to the public, that Sasquatches are in fact real animals, always been there. There's nothing to fear necessarily. They should be respected just like bears or anything else. They're potentially dangerous, but they're not out to get us. And as evidence, I would offer, look around. If they were out to get us, there'd be very few of us left. But they're there. They always have been. And it's cool. And you don't have to stop hunting because you saw one and you're scared. It's cool. They've always been there. They're just a perfectly normal animal, part of the environment. It's totally cool. They're there. But second of all, we also do our own field work, essentially. We're out there as much as we can. We were out last night. Team members out right now as I speak. So between all four of us here at the shop and our colleagues, we're out at least once or twice a week, maybe more, sometimes. So we're collecting our own data because at this point, like footprint casts are rad. I love them. And I'm trying to collect as many as I can because it's data. Sighting reports are great. They tell us where somebody might have seen one. It kind of gives a little window into the Sasquatch's life. I have to look at every piece of footage and every piece of evidence like it could be hoaxed. I mean, that's just the way it is. I busted a hoax last week on Twitter, actually. Somebody was trying to pass off a photograph of a Sasquatch, and it turns out, no, it was actually Murphy. It was our Bigfoot here at the North American Bigfoot Center. like two nights ago, somebody saw me do that or whatever, then they sculpted a footprint in the ground and said, Cliff, I found this at Mount Rainier. Can you verify it for me? So people are always trying to set me up. I'm like the big guy at the bar. Everybody wants to fight me. I have to look at everything extra close so I don't get pulled into some hoax like I have before. Therefore, the only research I can truly 100% depend on is my own. So I'm trying to make sure that I do my diligence and get out there as much as I can to try to gather information about the Sasquatches in my area and do what I can. The second prong of the NABC's mission really is. And then finally, the last, which is very, very important to me, is finding and curating and preserving historical artifacts because Sasquatches are real animals. And someday this history, this prehistory of Bigfoot is going to take on more importance. And there's going to be a lot of information in here that was immediately ignored. There's a history here that I think is really interesting and cool. And it sheds some light about where we are now, too, because we're standing on the shoulders of those giants. If you don't know who John Green is, you know, if you don't know who Rene de Hinden is or Grover Krantz or these people like that, you're missing out on a big chunk of what Bigfooting is at this point. And then there's these unsung heroes that very few people know about for whatever reason, which is a tragedy. Like Chuck Edmonds, for example, or Barbara Wasson or Larry Lund or Joel Hurd. These people.
You just posted a thing on Chuck, didn't you? Just like barely.
Oh, yeah. I posted something, a letter from John Green to Chuck Edmonds.
Yeah.
And that's an example of what we're doing here at the NEBC. We obtained a large portion. Rumors come in that there's some more out there that might be headed our way. But we have the Chuck Edmonds collection, for example. I'm the owner of the Barbara Wasson collection. You know, she's an early female researcher. And I have correspondence between her and like Joyce Kearney, who has left us now. She's passed away. But I had the pleasure of knowing Joyce without knowing her importance at the time. It just aggravates me that I actually knew this woman and I didn't know her position in early Bigfoot history, because she was so just humble and everything about who she is. But what it comes down to is that we are trying to find and locate historical artifacts, things that if their sons and daughters don't recognize the importance of them, will be thrown away after these people's demise. Basically saving history from the trash can here at the North American Bigfoot Center. And now we're started the arduous process archiving these things. That thing I posted on the North American Bigfoot Center members page that you saw, again, was a letter from September of 1967, written by John Green to Chuck Edmonds. And it was a very interesting letter, too, because he was talking about the Blue Creek Mountain footprint trackway, which is a very famous trackway. I'm sure a lot of your listeners know about this. From August of 1967, hundreds, over 600 footprints were found, and most of them documented. They weren't all casts, a handful of the casts are still out there, mostly in John Green's collection and a few other random places, but there's a lot of photographs of it. It was that footprint find that set Roger and Bob going to Bluff Creek in October, and who got the film. They got the film in October. And that letter was written in September. So a really interesting time in history between those two pivotal events. This history is out there and it should be preserved. It's like Smithsonian level stuff, as far as I'm concerned.
Agreed. Yes.
Yeah. And
agreed,
no one else is doing it. It doesn't mean everybody should be doing it. I just maybe care a little bit more, and I have the facility here at the North American Bigfoot Center to do it. Everywhere I look, there's little things that need to be documented and stuff. I have a bag down here full of artifacts from the Chuck Edmonds collection. It's like one of five bags that I have, plus 30 audio tapes that I need to digitize. So if people out there, they want to help in any way, yeah, you can be a member and be privy to this stuff, and you can see the stuff that you get to see. Because I don't post it on Facebook. I mean, Facebook seems to be more and more like a place where you go to show off what mental illness you have. You know,
like, I agree. It just
doesn't make sense. Who cares about your politics? Like, who cares what you think? Who cares what I think? You know, but I tell people all the time, like, I don't care what you think, and you really shouldn't care what I think. I'm of very little importance. There's a larger thing going on, this mosaic that we're all participating in. So I don't post what I'm doing on Facebook because I just can't handle the trolls, essentially. So everything I do goes on the membership thing at the North American Bigfoot Center. Thank you guys for being members. I do appreciate it. I hope you're getting something out of it.
Absolutely. But
if people out there, if they have things, even if you don't think they're interesting or useful, I mean, who knows what you might be sitting on? I'm soliciting donations to the museum of anything, newspaper articles. Maybe you have a letter that you wrote or you got received from Rene de Hinden back in the day or something. I mean, who knows what you have? Copies, any Bigfoot stuff. We never say no to any donation, because there's been times, even in the brief 3-year period that we've been open, where I got something as a donation and I go, well, this is interesting. I don't know what I'm going to do with it. The thing off the top of my head, like, here, I got that. There's a fast food joint in the town called Burgerville. And at some point or another, they made a baby Bigfoot plate. Somebody gave me this like years ago. And I say, well, okay, I don't know what I'm going to do with that. That's cool. I kind of filed it away, put it away. And then like this past year, someone came up and they gave me another artifact from this, like of this same Bigfoot icon thing in a keychain form. It's like, oh, things are starting to come together. And now like maybe at some point the NABC will do some sort of like food related Bigfoot display. We already have a Bigfoot and beverages thing planned where we're going to put a bunch of beer and wine and other booze, essentially, that Bigfoot related. But I never know how things are going to come together, you know, because again, I'm not driving this car. I'm just along for the ride. And so we never say no to any donation at all because we don't know what's going to come next year. And maybe some other piece of the puzzle is going to show up and we can put these things together for people to enjoy or learn from. So maybe some of your listeners are sitting on something that like you think it's cool, but you don't know what to do with it. You know, Kevin Llewellyn, the researcher from Spokane I mentioned, he donated his own personal collection of Roger Patterson's newsletters that he subscribed to. Wow. Roger Patterson's fan club thing when he was just a little boy. He saw Roger speak at the Spokane Coliseum, got Roger's autograph, which is proudly displayed here at the North American Bigfoot Center, got his official membership card, like his little placard certificate, his name on it and everything typed on there by Roger's typewriter. Yeah, so you just never know what's going to come your way. So we are open doors. You can donate anything you'd like to us. We'll never say no, and we'll always say thank you.
Awesome. Anything else you want to leave with us before we sign off?
I don't know. I do a podcast. Maybe try to listen to it. Maybe you'll like it, you know?
Oh, we listen to it all the time.
Yeah, Bigfoot and Beyond with Cliff and Bobo. It's on, I don't even know, I don't listen to podcasts, so I can't tell you where to listen to it, but it's on all the major podcasts.
It's on all of them. Yeah, I listen on Spotify, but it's on all of them.
Come to the museum, say hi, be kind to one another. Don't be a dick on Facebook, and you know, that's all I ask of people. So, you know.
That's good advice.
Thank you, Cliff. We appreciate it.
No problem. Thanks for having me on.
If you enjoy our show, please like, subscribe, and leave a 5-star review. For more information, you can visit www.destination-mystery.com. Find your own destination
and solve the mystery.